Алексей Анатольевич против Ксении Анатольевны.
Раунд сказочная 3. Болезнь.
Я бы хотела, чтобы Леонид просто извинился.
Ксения, и вы очень некрасиво, Ксения.
Понятно, что на этих выборах выиграет Путин.
The two most visible opposition figures are trading insults. The country's most reputable pollster has been muzzled. The biggest debate appears to be not about whom to vote for, but whether to vote at all. And the authorities are enticing young people to come to the ballot by offering chance to win a free iPhone. Is this an election, a reality show, or a soap opera? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the book Vody, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also with us in the studio is Anna Eratunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group and author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome back, Anna. Congratulations on the new job and welcome to Prague.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Great to have you here. Anna, let's start with you since you're just in from Moscow. And let's start with a general and work our way into the specifics. What's the vibe as everybody stumbles back to work from the winter holidays as this very unusual election campaign gets underway? What's it feel like in Moscow, though?
Well, I must say, and I kind of hate to say this because it's not very media savvy, but I get the distinct sense that no one really cares this time. I'm just going to, you know, state the obvious here, because this is not 2012 when things were at stake. Right now, it's like, you know, just this is just going to happen. We've accepted that, and let's see how it goes.
So it's a big collective shrug.
Basically, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mark, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is after all the big challenge for the Kremlin as it continues to make this pretense that this is a democracy, which, I mean, there are certain aspects in which it is, but certainly not in the most important sort of power-related ones. It means it has this inconvenient necessity to go through elections. And not only does Putin himself seem bored with so much of the structure and the rituals that he himself has created, well, no wonder then that most Russians are equally bored.
So this is the election that isn't? You have to wonder why they're even bothering then.
Well, they have to bother. I mean, otherwise, then the whole pretense is gone. And amongst other things, we have to be honest that generally Putin seems to regard it as important to observe the formalities. Things actually happen. The very fact of the castling, when he brought in his little sock puppet Medvedev, that says something. He could have rewritten the constitution, or he could have just simply said, what are you going to do about it? But he didn't. He went through this, and obviously in part it was because he was also wondering if he could stand down. So, I mean, I think that they have to go through this. But the point is that elections are always problematic simply because they sometimes naturally generate political enthusiasm, and sometimes they require the artificial creation of political enthusiasm. So on the one hand, you've got, and clearly the obvious example here is Navalny, genuinely being able to actually create some degree of passion amongst his admittedly small constituency. And then on the other hand, you have the state desperately trying to work out how it can create the facsimile thereof.
I would agree they need this for legitimization. But if this is such, if the result is a collective shrug, are they going to get any legitimacy out of this legitimization ritual?
Well, one could say that actually most genuinely legitimate democratic governments essentially survive on a series of collective shrugs. The point is that this is a different regime. It presented itself as different. It presented itself not just as we are able to win the election in purely constitutional terms, to actually elections are a chance for the country to demonstrate its passion and support for Putin and everything he stands for. Now, the problem for the government would be, can it pivot? Can it pivot away from elections as essentially referenda to elections in a normal Westernish sort of sense? Now, I think the answer is not.
I don't think they want to.
Well, but then, in which case, and I know we're going to be talking about this in the second part, In which case, actually, the whole question of turnout becomes of supreme importance, and what they're willing to do in order to get, and if need be, manufacture the result that they want. So I think at the moment, anyway, that's a fallback. At the moment, I think they are still trying to do things to ensure that the election is, shall we say, the least painful experience for them as possible.
Would you agree on it? I mean, is this...
I would suggest that maybe this collective shrug is not really such a bad thing for the Kremlin. I mean, maybe the Kremlin doesn't really need this heartfelt enthusiasm for Putin. It's basically in a corridor where it needs to avoid the kind of, you know, it needs to avoid 90% because that's kind of embarrassing. And it needs to avoid, you know, the kind of things that we saw in 2012 with Bolotnaya, where you've got overt opposition. So in that kind of scenario, it needs to have this legitimization of this ritual of legitimization, as any regime does. But under the circumstance, maybe it does. Maybe it would benefit from things going as quietly as possible. Maybe apathy is not such a disaster. Maybe this is really the only way to go ahead and do these things. I mean, if we're talking about a fake election, maybe the whole point here is fake it until you make it. Maybe that's what they're following through with.
So passive acquiescence rather than mobilization. Mm-hmm. Now, where this election is exciting is on the opposition side. And where it's exciting is with one person who's not going to be on the ballot and one person who probably is and who are fighting with each other. The Navalny Sobchak spat is actually very... it's revealing, and it's... When Sobchak first announced her intention to run... My feeling at the time was that her candidacy could be consequential if she and Navalny acted in concert, not in opposition to each other, because I thought they would have a chance to disrupt the Kremlin's narrative, her from the inside, him from the outside. But I also argued at the time if they begin operating at cross purposes, it plays right into the Kremlin's hands. Right now, it looks like they're doing the latter. What is your takeaway from the whole Navalny situation?
Well, I was always far, far more skeptical/cynical about Sobchak for a start. I didn't think there was any chance that she was actually going to become a kind of serious anti-Kremlin candidate, that she clearly was there because the Kremlin wanted.
Neither did I, but I thought she also had the possibility to play her own game in that context and potentially spoil the ritual.
The point at which you start playing your own game is the point at which the investigatory committee starts looking at your tax returns. It's the point at which you get rather more serious treatment than just simply a high-profile search of your apartment. No, I mean, I didn't see any signs that that was the case. And I think this is what we're seeing. I mean, and the interesting thing is that we are seeing, on the one hand, Navalny being pushed increasingly into the outer limits with this suggestion that, in fact, he's basically a pawn of the Americans and so forth. So he's now being demonized, whereas once upon a time he was just simply ignored. The non-candidate. Now he is actually the foreign agent candidate.
Right.
And you also have Sobchak now beginning to actually sort of basically come in with an overt sort of attack, you know, when we had this case of her going and trying to basically force an apology on live camera.
From Volkov. Yeah.
Exactly, his Navalny's sort of campaign manager and so forth. The kind of tactics which, if it was the other way round, would have been roundly castigated in the media and probably sort of investigated as harassment or something like that. So, I mean, I think you know, we are clearly seeing this widening gap with Sobchak as a bit of sort of star power pseudo opposition, and Navalny being squeezed as far as possible out of the scene.
So mission accomplished there then.
I think so. And the interesting thing will be whether actually Sobchak does make it onto the ballot or not. You know, it might well be that they will decide that her mission has been done enough and she doesn't need to actually be in the presidential running.
Okay.
That'll be interesting because, let's face it, there's almost no chance that she could have independently gathered together enough signatures to run in the actual ballot without the Kremlin at the very least not seeking to put a spanner in the works.
Anna?
Well, I think from the start I was I think it was impossible that Sobchak and Navalny could have operated in concert. I mean, that was just, given the structure of the situation, out of the question. The reason that Sobchak went for this was because she saw this as a business opportunity. That's what she's in this for. Now, she can layer, she can justify that with all sorts of nice ideas about how this will bring debate about certain topics into the national conversation. She can initially, maybe she there were some ideas that just by simply mentioning the name Navalny and saying nice things about him, I could, you know, boost this. But essentially, this was just this spat that they're now having, this dispute. It was bound to happen. It was embedded in it from the start, and the Kremlin was counting on it.
Now, at the heart of the spat between Navalny and Sobchak is a serious argument over whether or not to boycott the vote. Navalny's been calling for a boycott. Sobchak says, no, vote for me. I'm the against all candidate. They're having a serious debate. There's been a lot of debate in the Russian media, especially the opposition media, about the merits of a boycott. Dmitry Oreshkin had a very good piece in snob.ru a week ago on the mathematics of a boycott. What do you, Mark, what do you take? How do you see this whole debate about the boycott, or to boycott or not to boycott?
Well, I think one can approach it on two levels. One of them is, especially on the face value of what is the most effective way of demonstrating opposition to this regime. Mm. And on that level, I can understand the appeal of the idea of a no against everyone candidate. When you know that there's no chance that you actually can win, so rather than in a way faffing around with presenting an alternative platform for a government that will never, ever, ever exist,
right?
Why not just simply say, we are unhappy with the situation and create that? So I can see the appeal of Sobchak's argument. But the crucial point is, these are not real elections. This is not actually in any way, shape or form a genuine poll. And my problem is this. Navalny is absolutely right that it is in some ways the turnout rather than the vote that really is crucial, not least because it is one of the things that is easier to actually monitor from the outside. You know, if you are clearly watching a polling station and you know that only 50 people went there and then 500 ballots
right.
appear from there, you know that there's a problem. On the other hand, 500 people go into a polling station and do their quote-unquote secret ballot, which is completely under the control of the authorities. Now, it might well be that 200 of them vote for Sobchak, or it might be that two of them vote for Sobchak, but the actual result is much, much easier for the state to manipulate.
So manipulating the result is easier
so
than manipulating
the I think Sobchak's approach is one that only makes sense if you actually have some degree of belief in the validity of the actual vote. And since I don't, that's why I feel that Navalny's on the right angle. And even, I mean, the interesting thing is, and well, I know we're going to come on to the issue of sort of apathy and outcomes, but Oreshkin, one of his key points was that there are these, well, he calls them sultanates.
Right.
I mean, districts in which clearly strong leaders can get the vote out in finest Tammany Hall style.
Like Chechnya, for example.
Yeah, but even you know, that Chechnya is, as in almost everything, Chechnya is always the extreme example.
Right.
But no, I mean, there are others, you know, Amantuleyev, right. Satrapy, and so forth. And I think it's a really good insight. However, the issue is not so much, oh, well, if people don't vote, then the final outcome will be disproportionately affected by these satrapies.
Yeah, because in the more competitive yeah. areas, then the vote will be depressed.
Exactly. The, yeah. But rather, I think what will be interesting and important will be actually if we see a massive discrepancy in the levels of voting between these areas which are much, much more controlled and these areas which, for want of a better word, we could call freer.
Right.
Because one of the key things that the Russian government is going to have to consider is how much political capital does it want to put into rigging the vote? Of course, the vote, you might say, is already rigged by the fact of excluding Navalny, right. of control of the media, et cetera, all these things we know about. But also there will be the actual rigging that takes place on the day.
Mm-hmm.
The more and the more obviously they do it, the more there is the risk of a backlash, and the more in some ways they will end up delegitimating themselves mm-hmm. in pursuit of what look like legitimating numbers. So, I mean, I think actually if Navalny could genuinely bring the vote down, that would have a delegitimating impact, but also it's something that it's harder for the state to rig.
Well, and it's an interesting thing, and Oreskin notes this in his piece, and I was looking at the numbers before I went into the studio, but the turnout in Russian presidential elections has been steadily declining. There was a blip up in 2008, but then it went back down again in 2012. But since 1991, almost in each election, with one exception, the turnout has decreased. We probably can expect it to decrease in this election as well. Navalny can take credit for that, whether or not. Oreskin makes the point that the boycott benefits Navalny for this reason, but it doesn't benefit. It won't decrease Putin's overall number for the same reason. Now, I know you think it's missing the point from what you're saying. Anna, to boycott or not to boycott?
Well, I think that turnout in this case is, I think, far more inconsequential than the Kremlin gives it credit for. I think what's going on here is that at this point they've reached a point where something needs to be done. There needs to be some sort of busy work. Let's up voter turnout. And then Navalny's kind of buying into that argument by basically trying to lower it. Whether it's high or whether it's low is not really going to change things. It's not going to change the election results. It's not going to change it's not going to change Putin's legitimacy. Short of something completely embarrassing, sentiment about what's actually going on and support for the Kremlin, this isn't really going to have an effect. So I think again, within the kind of framework that we're seeing here, this election that doesn't really matter. It's like let's just do the work. Let's just do the stuff that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Let's have a decent voter turnout. And obviously Navalny, who has always argued that this is not a real election, he's going to continue arguing that by suggesting this boycott, is going to fall right into their argument.
Now, we mentioned I think it's actually interesting, though, if you go back to 2011, the Duma elections that year, Navalny was arguing against a boycott, if you remember correctly. There was this debate between him and Boris Nemtsov before the election. Nemtsov was calling for a boycott, but Navalny was saying, vote for anybody but United Russia. Mm-hmm. Anybody. The communists, Zhirinovsky, it doesn't matter. Anybody but United Russia. The goal is to drive down their total. Navalny was right in that argument, actually. It turned out he was right. This time he's arguing something completely the opposite. I think it's an interesting contrast.
We also should remember that Navalny back then said that he would not run for president because this is not a legitimate election. Right. The fact that this is not a legitimate election has not changed, and yet he's trying to run for president. So I think Navalny is a very pragmatic person who is not really prone to doubling down on some principles or ideas. He's going to in a good way, maybe in a smart way, try to change them to adapt to the situation that he sees going on around him.
But also, I think there's also a difference. I'd agree, but I think there's also a difference between the Duma and the presidency in terms of legitimacy. The Duma has no real legitimacy. No one has any illusions about the power of the Duma. But on the other hand, like it or not, there are going to be people elected to the Duma. And they're not all United Russia. It's not a guaranteed thing. There are representatives of the communists, of the liberal democrats, and so forth. So, I think in that case, having a low turnout for the Duma, all that says is parliament doesn't matter, and wow, that's not exactly going to be a shock.
Right.
Whereas, actually, the whole point, I would say, of Putin is precisely that he's not a political figure.
Mm-hmm.
He is somehow some kind of suprapolitical representation of the nation, and I think that is where actually this legitimacy comes from, and needs to be
continually regenerated.
Exactly. Sure, he will win. That's not in question. But if he just wins on an acceptable but uninspiring margin, that does not give him extra juice. Now, okay, one could say, sure, he has complete control of the system. He doesn't need it. The National Guard are not going to turn around and say, we're now slightly more going to question your orders or anything like that. Of course not. But on the other hand, as it were, the extent to which there is a facade of legitimacy and constitutionality to the system, I think does actually depend on the presidential vote in a way that the Duma doesn't. Mm.
Now, sticking with Navalny, but the Kremlin's tactics on him, and Mark, you alluded to this earlier, the move from ignoring him to now calling him basically a foreign agent in a patsy of the Americans. What accounts? What do you think accounts for that? And is it wise? Is this going to work?
I have no idea if it's going to work or not. I suppose it depends really
does
on...
Does it strike you as wise?
Well, I think it strikes me as, in a way, a reflection of what we're seeing is that they have given up on early thoughts that they could have some kind of controlled pseudo-election. I mean, Navalny was never going to be standing, but that sense that they could try and just maintain as far as possible the veneer of making it look like it's a real election. And, oh, well, if only Navalny hadn't got caught for that terrible embezzlement. And enough said about that. Now I think they're deciding to go all out. And I think also what we're actually seeing is in some ways a harbinger of post-election strategy. In that if you haven't got active legitimacy on the same scale, at the very least you can marginalise, silence and destroy your enemies and your critics and your rivals. So, I mean, I think we're seeing a hint that, in fact, the next presidency will be, and it seems bizarre to be saying this, given that the current presidency is not exactly warm and fluffy, but I think the next presidential term will at least start in even more hawkishly vicious terms.
Domestically?
Yeah.
Anna, would you agree with that? Because there's a lot of talk in Moscow that there's going to be a thaw after the election.
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure. I've been asked this before, and my intuition, this is like purely intuitive, I'm leaning towards the thaw.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why that is, like, analytically, can I explain, you know, again, this is a black box. We don't know what actually precipitates the Kremlin to, you know, take this or this line or that. But given just the idea that the Kremlin is always full of surprises and that we don't know what's going on. I mean, sure, why not? In terms of specifically Navalny and targeting...
Branding him,
yes. I mean, for reasons that I'd like to get into later on, why it's using this tactic. Well, first of all, it's always been doing this.
Yes,
this is how it deals with any opposition threats. Just to say that it's, you know, from abroad, from Europa or whatever. To the extent, is this going to work? Again, I have to say I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether or not this is going to work either. I mean, with Navalny's base, which is what counts for him,
mm-hmm.
I don't see it resonating.
I mean, one of the reasons I say thaw is because, frankly, I feel that that would be the wisest thing to do
right.
at this point. That doesn't.
We know that that's always the benchmark that it is adopted.
Right. But I think we're reaching. We've reached a point where this is like clearly or almost clearly Putin's last term, and I think there's a it's like kind of last weeks of school
right.
attitude. You know, it's like, oh, what doesn't matter.
And, I mean, another thing, I mean, this is kind of like the mishmash podcast. We're all over the place. But Zhuganov's not running for president this time. Gennady Zhuganov will not. This will be an election without Gennady Zhuganov. When was the last time that happened? The new communist candidate, Grudinin. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's and it's worth mentioning. We have this fascinating example of a Communist Party candidate who happens not to be a member of the party. And if anything, I mean, he at one point was United Russia. But again, I think that very much says something about what we're seeing is in some other countries. We have seen communist parties become first kind of Euro-communist and then social democrat and move slowly into the political mainstream. Well, in some ways, actually, what I would suggest is Grudinin represents a kind of mainstreaming. It's just it's a very different kind of mainstream that it's moving into.
Right, it's Russia mainstream.
Exactly. In some ways, it is precisely that what Grudinin is doing is dragging the Communist Party into being the kind of the slightly less neocon United Russia. Because after all, this is a guy who on the one hand is an exceedingly wealthy man who runs this large farm, which is a very successful business, and apparently he runs it well. And at the same time, it is a farm which actually has this very, very paternalistic approach to its employees. It looks after them, it pays them well, it provides them with accommodation and so forth. I mean, this is not so much socialism as, you know, if I think of...
corporatism.
It's good old-fashioned 19th century paternalistic capitalism. It's, you know, one could go to places like Bourneville which was where the British chocolate magnate had his factory and built model housing and so forth. I mean, this is it. It's actually we now have almost the Communist Party just simply becoming the face of the nicer capitalists. Right. Whereas United Russia is much more for the red tooth and claw. Now, I mean, I don't know if this is quite how they conceive of it, but I think it reflects this trend that's been taking place. But the very fact of Grudinin, I mean, I think he's interesting because precisely he is someone who actually could, in theory, appeal to... I mean, he's not going to oust Putin, right. And I don't think he's going to be Putin's successor or anything like that. But nonetheless, in some ways, he appeals to a similarish base. I think Zyuganov had reached the point where basically... He was a caricature of himself who stood for only a caricature of the Communist Party's elite. I mean, or electorate. You know, the people who basically would not vote for anyone else would vote for Zyuganov. Grudinin, I think, actually has the opportunity to slightly expand the potential support base, precisely because he has less of the baggage and he seems to be much more in keeping with the modern times. And I think the interesting thing is, although obviously the Kremlin and, more to the point, the political technicians and the presidential administration are quite happy with this, they're quite happy with a situation in which you actually have, again, someone who might make the election look a little bit more real. But I think the pressure for Grudinin actually came from within the Communist Party.
Uh-huh.
Where, I mean, it is clear that there are a certain number of people who are saying, for God's sake, well, I don't think they said for God's sake necessarily, but, you know, for Lenin's sake, we cannot possibly run Zyuganov again. You know, it does become the point where we actually do begin to look like a particularly bad tribute act. And I think... In some ways, Grudinin represented a compromise between the communists and the presidential administration. Someone who was acceptable to the system, but also was not just purely a Zyuganov retread.
What's your take on Mr. Grudinin?
Well, I would agree, and I'd add to that in the last maybe decade or so, gradually within the left, I've been definitely seeing this. At least this growing demand for something more pragmatic, more corporate. I mean, maybe not having much to do with socialism, but this definitely represents that kind of increasingly popular attitude of let's counter money, let's get things done. And in terms of this paternalistic corporatism, I think in the Russian context right now, this is really where it could go.
Now, there's one more thing I wanted to hit on before we move into the second part, and that is that we won't be getting any public opinion polls from any pollster that is not associated with the Kremlin. The Levada Center announced this week that it, because it had been branded a foreign agent, it was not releasing its election polls. We're not going to get any independent information about public opinion. Important?
I think so. I mean, I think important in two ways. One is that this is the Levada Center desperately trying to kind of hang on to its independence by not provoking the Kremlin, and I think realizing that this is an area that is just too sensitive. And again, I think this is emblematic of the kind of compromises a lot of people in Moscow and elsewhere in Russia are having to make. Is it best to try and do a little bit of good, even if you're doing much less good than you would like? Or do you risk it all and find yourself unable to do anything? But the second point is precisely, again, I think this is in part the Kremlin setting itself up. I don't know if it's decided definitely, but in case it really does want to do some distinctly extensive vote rigging, it's important to make sure that you do not then have an independent benchmark whereby people can measure it. You know, if people are sort of, if there's a stream of polls that are suggesting that turnout's going to be 60%, for example,
right,
and then on the day it's 75%, then that's a point where people are thinking, this is strange. So in a way, what you might want is for the agencies that are going to be informing the discussion and therefore the expectation beforehand, you want to make sure that their one's under your control. And for this reason, I think that's why Levada realised that it was going to be getting into the crosshairs of the Kremlin.
You think that they were pressured into doing this, or you think they
I'm not sure if it would actually have to be pressured in the sense of someone actually going banging on their door and saying, you know, lovely polling outfit you got here, a shame if it burned down. I think they are very, very well aware of the kind of the environment in which they operate. And I think this is why, you know, maybe quite possibly there was a little nod and a wink and they thought, okay. Or maybe they just felt, no, you know, we're wandering into a minefield here. Yeah.
Do you agree on it?
Well, I wanted to...
kind of strange, this election without Levada polls coming out.
Yes, but I mean, maybe I'm in the minority here, but I've been looking at polls. I mean, I study public opinion very closely. And to be honest, I've never really been able to say this, but is there really that big a difference between the numbers that we see coming out of Levada and the numbers that we see coming out of Tsuom and Fum? I'm not sure. I'm not going to like insist that...
Tsuom just came out with a poll that has turnout over 70% and Putin's vote over 70%, which is, surprise, surprise, the Kremlin's goal. I haven't seen those kind of numbers mm-hmm. at any Levada poll recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've been doing different mm-hmm. polls. But, you know, when I look at just general figures, I don't see... yes, there is a discrepancy, obviously, but it's not huge. And I think that mainly this, the foreign agent label is obviously an act of symbolism here. It would have been really nice to have Levada operating. I think the real effect is the statement of what they've done and the symbolism of what the Kremlin is doing to stifle independent voices like that.
So you mean the chill that their announcement created?
Yes.
Yeah.
I can just push back slightly against that in the sense of I agree that on the whole we don't see a major discrepancy between Levada, Tsuom, and Fom figures, though there clearly are differences. I think what is important is that, and likewise, I mean, you know, I certainly do not believe that the people who work at Tsuom and Fom mm-hmm. are just purely, you know, craven government stooges or whatever. You know, they're actually people who want to do their job and so forth. But on the other hand, these are agencies that are much, much more prone to and vulnerable to pressure. And again, I think it's not so much we are definitely going to rig these elections mm-hmm. massively. It's that I'm sure there's someone sitting there thinking, contingency. Mm-hmm. We may want to, let's clear the ground for us. But then the other thing about Levada is it asked more interesting questions, in my opinion, than the other two.
I would agree, yeah.
And
definitely.
I think particularly it's their polling that really, I think, has shown up this massive and fascinating discrepancy between headline support for Putin and then the more granular, do you think the country's going in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Do you think mm-hmm. that Putin is responsible for the level of corruption? Those kind of questions. I think it's just wanting to just clear the decks a bit from these people who... You know, for some reason, they keep asking the inconvenient questions. Let's put them on hold for a few months.
Okay, well, that's a good note to shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look what may be Putin's biggest opponent in this election, the whatever factor. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vodi, Russia's Super Mafia. And also with us in the studio is Anna Aratunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group and author of the book, The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Владимир Путин выиграет президентские выборы в марте.
Я главное за Путина.
Сегодня у Путина горячее сердце.
Избирательный фонд Владимира Путина достиг максимально возможного размера.
Ну, участникам предложат сделать селфи на избирательном участке и выложить его в социальных сетях.
A selfie contest to win a free iPhone. A dating app to find voting partners. Local festivals on polling day. The Kremlin is pulling out all the stops in an effort to boost turnout on March 18th. But as Bloomberg columnist Leonid Bershinsky wrote last week, the real contestants in this election are Putin and whatever, a concept that is not easy to reflect in a traditional poll. Putin's greatest opponent, he suggests, is a collective shrug. Kremlin watchers have argued that the most important figure to watch in this election is the turnout figure, which, by the way, has been steadily declining in Russia's presidential elections. Mark, we've been through some of this ground in the first half, but how big a problem really is voter apathy for Putin? is a collective shrug really Putin's greatest enemy?
Well, look, I mean, I know that Anna will be talking about nationalism and sort of more active forces. So, yes, let me be the one who talks about the passive and boring ones. I think it is, because, again, I think we have to realise, look, there are two separate issues at work here. One is the practicalities of power. And from the practicalities of power, this election does not matter in the slightest. I'm sure you've been getting the same, you know, people getting in touch with you, journalists or whatever, saying, you know, we want to write a piece about Russia after the elections. And there's always a part of me that thinks, why?
Right.
Why? I mean, Russia after the elections, it's going to be the same as Russia before the elections.
Right,
you know, we have this tendency to overlay this notion that elections equal change. And clearly elections will not in this context. So on one level, look, this doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if there's just 51% vote for Putin or not. However, I do feel that there is also this much less sort of visible and easily definable notion about the legitimacy of a state and how that actually helps inform how everyone else looks at it. The point is that you might say, if you feel that the state and the leader are not just massively entrenched within the power structure, but also that basically everyone else thinks that they're doing an amazingly good job, it tends to actually squeeze out the room for debate and criticism. You know, we are basically herd beasts at heart. And likewise, I think that if it actually looks as if one can say, the old man's slipping a bit, the regime doesn't look quite as solid, then this in itself becomes something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That in fact it therefore encourages others. And I'm struck by the extent to which we're already, and I know we've done things we talked about already quite often, about the extent to which people are already discussing post-Putinism.
Yeah.
Now, in this respect, the election is important because it is one of these necessary tests. There are all kind of other situations in which, as it were, Putin can create tests for himself and his legitimacy. But this is one that is foisted upon him by the electoral cycle. And people will inevitably check it against previous ones. As you said, with any way a declining turnout, people will be looking at, well, okay, what do these figures show? What do they give as a sense of the will of the country? And I think that does matter, even though it's always very hard to actually pin it down. It does not matter in the sense of meaning that Putin can't appoint who he wants as prime minister or whatever. Of course not. But in terms of just the general sense of, is this a powerful and dynamic regime,
the aura of power,
or is it one that actually is slipping into stagnation and decline?
Would you agree on? And I know you have other things, other opponents of Putin that maybe rearing their heads soon.
I would say that, and I mentioned this earlier. I mean, apathy, I don't think is such a huge problem at this point. I mean, yes, if you're going to pick an enemy, pick apathy because it's easier to deal with. I would suggest that what we're getting into during this last term is somehow a byproduct of the Kremlin in many ways, and that's rising nationalist sentiment. That, interestingly enough, the reason Navalny is becoming so successful is he's actually pretty good at absorbing that and turning that into something more or less moderate. Now it might be more moderate, but that also means that it's more potent as a real oppositionist threat to the Kremlin. Now at Crisis Group, we've been doing some work on how the Kremlin has been mobilizing patriotism and nationalism, and in some ways, you can kind of see that this is kind of a genie that's been let out of the bottle. And one of the reasons, when I mentioned earlier, why the Kremlin would be really well placed to actually focus on a thaw. Is that, if you look back last time when its way of dealing with the opposition was to, again, pivot to nationalism and patriotism even more strongly than it had been doing in the past, right now I think it might not want to do that because it's unleashing a very popular and populist force whose actions it cannot necessarily predict. And I would say this, you know, this current move to iPhones and entertainment and Sobchak might actually be a good way to contain that threat. Let's not aggravate it too much. Let's focus on apathy. If that makes sense. I mean, this is general. If we're going to talk about what's going to happen down the line in this next 6 years, I would say that would be the wise thing to do. It doesn't necessarily mean that's what the Kremlin will do, but I'm increasingly getting a sense that having done what it's done, having focused on patriotism, having done this patriotic mobilization, it might want to kind of scale back a little.
So how does this threat manifest itself, this nationalist threat? You mentioned Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Mark and I have looked at dissident nationalist groups. One of the, I guess, the rising, the real opposition right now is essentially nationalist.
Right.
And whoever comes next is going to have, in some ways, be tainted by that. Now, the reason this is a threat is because it's so popular and unpredictable. Now, it can manifest itself in extreme and radical groups, or it can manifest itself in something more moderate. One interesting example of how this has been playing out quite recently was the backlash against the Matilda film.
Right.
Now, initially, this was something that the Kremlin kind of inspired and, you know, with its rhetoric. But then we saw increasingly groups that authorities had to come in and label as extremist.
Mm-hmm.
It's an indication that these are really forces you don't want to mess with too much, because you never know which way it's gonna go.
Well, Navalny himself has kind of toned down his nationalist rhetoric.
Yes, definitely.
In recent years,
mm-hmm.
To the point where you don't really hear much of it out of him at all anymore.
And I think that's a very pragmatic thing to do, because he is he's in this not for the nationalism. He's in this to try to bolster support and build a viable oppositionist force. And to do that, he's going to play the populist card when necessary and kind of tone it down when necessary. And I think that's what he's been doing. And I think that's part of the success of it, is because you don't really have to... You can have nationalist sentiments and, pick and choose from the wide spectrum of things that Navalny has said. Or if you want to kind of scale it down, you've got that to choose from as well.
Mm. Mark, do you think nationalism is a serious threat to this Kremlin?
Yeah, I think we say nationalism and we tend to think of it in terms of either sort of ethno-national conflicts or else invading parts of your neighbours and that kind of thing. The issue is that, in fact, what we have seen emerge, and although it's still very much a minority approach at the moment, I think... as Anna's saying, does have real potential, is the patriotic critique of Putinism. It's actually, rather than, because at the moment we have tended to assume that there's Putinism and then there is a liberal, democratic, West-looking opposition. And that's fine, but the point is, that is always vulnerable to the charge, or precisely, well, you're just simply patsies of our enemies and you want to weaken us and so forth. What's interesting is actually, as you have people articulate the view, and frankly, rightly, that Putin and co. are not the avatars and the defenders of Russia. They are the exploiters. They are the people who have embezzled and stolen and basically ripped the heart out of Russia's economy, and in the process also, created all kinds of toxic legacies for the future. And you can do that in nationalist, or shall I say, patriotic terms, and say, we are fighting for the soul of Russia. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we want to become part of Gay Roper and that we want to be weak and so forth. We can be strong, we can have mighty armies, but in fact, we would have mightier armies if our leaders were not stealing from us. We would be able to do all the things that we can do now better, if our current leaders were not stealing from us. And I think this is one of the dangers. So in some ways, going back to Anna's point about exactly the sort of the risk of nationalism, there is a risk of nationalism as in that it becomes this sort of Russians versus Dagestanis versus Bashkirians, whatever, or there is the political risk of nationalism that someone can come along and actually articulate that. And that, I think, has always been the potentiality within Navalny and why Navalny is dangerous. He's not dangerous simply because he looks and sounds hip and Western. He's dangerous because precisely he can tap into these things. And I think, although Navalny has toned down his ethno-nationalist rhetoric, but, for example, he still holds the line on Crimea.
Although he says very little about foreign affairs.
He says very little about foreign affairs because he knows, I mean, there is no way he can win on foreign affairs. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, on that one touchstone issue, you have Ksenia Sobchak talking in terms of, you know, another referendum, which, you know, implicitly throws open the idea that Crimea could be returned.
Right.
Whereas Navalny is clearly at the point of saying, well, you know, it may have been wrong, but basically what's done is done. You know, he is definitely not willing to lose that sort of nationalist perspective. And I still think this is one of the reasons why he had that surreal conversation on camera with Strelkov. It was not really for anything that was said, and he was very much kind of, I would say, very sort of much toning himself down for that. But he wanted to demonstrate that he was not an enemy of the anti-Kremlin nationalist wing.
Mm. On any thoughts on that before we wrap it up?
No, I agree. I mean, like this threat is. I mean, it can come from many different vectors, and I think the biggest one is really just this populist element. Just how much potential success it could have.
I want to throw something out here to wrap it up. I mean, we discussed? We have apathy. We have latent nationalism that's becoming manifest. And we have a decaying regime. What are those three things add up to?
Oh, dear.
Are we in a very dangerous position?
Empire right in its late stages. Mark, be an optimist.
Latent nationalism, apathy, and a decaying regime.
But for all that, and again, to up the surrealism quotient, let me sort of stand up and praise the virtues of a strong state apparatus and a pragmatic, self-interested, kleptocratic elite. The interesting thing is that these are indeed, if you put those three ingredients together and you can easily start thinking,
historically,
oh
that's
my God,
a disturbing combination of ingredients.
It's Weimar or whatever. Mm-hmm. The big difference, though, is exactly Weimar took place at a point where basically you had a pretty much a failing state. Here, the state, if we're actually looking at in terms of the sinews and the bone and the muscle of the state apparatus, is in very good shape. Mm. And the elite, they have all kinds of disagreements and disputes over, you know, how you share up the pie, the exact nature of the rules of the game and so forth. But they are all very well aware that they do very well out of the situation. When you actually have the really dangerous situations, you know, exactly the Weimar shading into Hitler type thing, it's because the elite, or at least a large enough element, lets the barbarians in through the gate. Here, I think you have an elite that doesn't feel the need to let the barbarians in and has some bloody good gates. So, I mean, I think this is disturbing, but I think it's disturbing in the sense of what it means is that much of the political superstructure falls away and it reveals this rock solid, rigid, self interested substructure.
Kleptocratic Russia.
Exactly.
Like.
Now then. You know, then the question becomes which way that evolves. But the point is, I think kleptocratic Russia is pretty solid. And as I said, I mean, it sticks in my craw to be in praise of that. But if it's that or anarchic state collapse, I'll take kleptocratic Russia.
Yeah, I mean, kleptocratic Russia is just the newest name for Sistema, basically, which is how Russia is always operated going back.
And when that broke was precisely because not just that you had, you know, in the Gorbachev era, nationalism arising, decay of the system, and if not so much apathy, so much as anomy, but it's also then because precisely the elite were fragmented. That was the critical moment that actually allowed this system to collapse in such a catastrophic way.
And you have to wonder if the elite doesn't fragment, if they start to smell the end of this regime.
I think at the moment there's that sense of hanging together rather than hanging separately.
Okay. Well, that's an optimistic way. Well, I'm not sure if that's optimistic or not. Kleptocratic Russia is going to save us.
Well, under the circumstances, I would say it is.
It's the best we can do under the
circumstances. It is the Dmitry Medvedev of outcomes. It is the least worst outcome.
What a way to wrap it up. On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the book Vody, Russia's Super Mafia. Also with us in the studio has been Anna Arutunyan, a Moscow-based senior analyst on Russia for the International Crisis Group and author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion and for putting up with my cold.
Not a problem.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. I'll be in Washington next week as my schedule has gotten a bit hectic of late, so the podcast will not appear on January 26th, but we'll be back in action on February 2nd. Until then, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.